Welcome to Lung Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Matt Hellman from Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, and to begin, I asked him to comment on some of his research on immune-related adverse events with checkpoint inhibitors.
The advent of PD-1 therapies for lung cancer has been really revolutionary. And in most cases, somewhat remarkably, people tolerate these therapies quite well. I think the experience with the initial checkpoint inhibitors with CTLA-4 in melanoma and even in mouse models had suggested that there might be quite a bit of toxicity when using checkpoint blockade. But with PD-1 therapies, and in particular in patients with lung cancer, patients have done quite well. One of the more common toxicities, though, is thyroid dysfunction. And it seems like that comes from affecting the body's own autoimmunity. Rather than your immune system attacking your cancer, it's possible that these drugs can result in your immune system attacking other parts of your body instead. That is a variety of organs. Almost any organ theoretically can be affected, but it seems like the thyroid is one of the most common. In our series, it was about 20% of people who developed some thyroid dysfunction when they were treated with a PD-1 drug called pembrolizumab. It seems like across series that have been published, the number of people who develop thyroid dysfunction ranges from somewhere from 5 to 20%. And it seems like amongst the immune-related toxicities, it's the most common that we've seen. What we reported was how patients did with thyroid dysfunction, how those that developed thyroid dysfunction either benefited or didn't benefit in terms of the response to their cancer, and started to try and understand why does thyroid dysfunction occur in the first place. And so in the first part, we described patients who developed thyroid dysfunction. Unfortunately, although the side effect was common, very few patients actually had symptoms. None of the patients in our series were hospitalized because of thyroid dysfunction, and very few actually even noticed particular symptoms. And in some ways, that highlights the importance of screening for patients that have thyroid dysfunction because the symptoms can be subtle or even non-existent. And so as a result of that experience, I've changed my practice in terms of the frequency with which I check TSHs. I try and check TSH at baseline on everybody and then check it again about every other cycle. Because it's so important to find these if they occur, they tend to be permanent if they do occur, and sometimes the symptoms can be insidious. And so I do check the TSH quite regularly for my patients.
What's your vision of the pathophysiology here? I hear so many checkpoint cases now, I can't remember which cancer it came from, but somebody presented a case recently of somebody who seemed to go through a hyperthyroid phase clinically that they were actually able to detect and then became hypothyroid. I know that's not what usually happens, but what's your vision of the pathophysiology and how does it compare to the pathophysiology of autoimmune thyroid disease?
That's a great question. My sense from this particular series and patients that are treated in general is that most patients may well go through a period of hyperthyroidism that tends to be brief and may even be unrecognized in many patients. One of the virtues of this particular series that we reported was that TSH was checked at every visit. And so we were able to capture patients that had this period of hyperthyroidism that was otherwise clinically subtle and may have otherwise been missed.
What fraction of patients actually had the hyperthyroid state?
So many patients developed hyperthyroidism, say it was like 60%.
Wow.
And it may even be a higher percentage of people that physiologically develop hyperthyroidism, but it only lasts for a week or two and may well have been missed on the labs. And so I think that many patients may well go through this transient period of hyperthyroidism followed by more complete and what it seems to be permanent hypothyroidism.
Maybe you know, everybody knows this, but I was trying to remember again, autoimmune thyroid disease, and also you see exophthalmus, right?
You do in autoimmunity, though we haven't seen it in this context.
Right. Well, that's what I was going to ask you. Any idea about why you see it with autoimmune disease, but you don't see it here? Because you don't see it, right?
I haven't seen it, no. There may be something about the chronicity of that sort of thyroid dysfunction in patients that have pure autoimmune thyroid dysfunction, where in these cases, it tends to be very brief and very transient in terms of at least the hyperthyroidism. But there are some periods, I think there are some ways in which it overlaps physiologically, wherein we identified many of the patients who developed thyroid dysfunction also had antithyroid antibodies. And so the way by which patients are having this transient period of hyperthyroidism followed by permanent hypothyroidism may well be an autoimmune antibody attack against the thyroid that leads ultimately to its destruction.
So you think it's possible that these patients actually have like sort of asymptomatic autoimmune disease that wouldn't have been clinically manifest and then it gets kicked in by the PD-1 antibody?
I do. I think that's actually a great insight into how this is happening and one where the thyroid may just be a case study for how autoimmune toxicities are occurring in general. I think a lot of people think of these immune-related toxicities as being directly drug-related and probably T-cell related, but that may not be right, or at least it may be an incomplete description, wherein what may actually be happening is that patients have some low-lying, indolent, undetectable autoimmunity that's present at baseline, and that in the presence of PD-1 therapy, that autoimmunity is reinvigorated, and so that you sort of reveal a baseline autoimmunity.
That's really fascinating. As long as we're talking about the endocrine system and, you know, potentially a connection to the thyroid, what about the pituitary in terms of hypophysitis and hypopituitarism, and how does that manifest?
Yeah, so that's another important toxicity. It's fortunately a bit more uncommon than thyroid dysfunction. My own sense is that it occurs probably less than 5% of people. The common symptoms that I've experienced include particularly fatigue. And so for patients that feel fatigue, it's checking the ACTH and cortisol along with the TSH are common blood tests that I would do. I haven't routinely screened patients with ACTH and cortisol, I think in particular just because of the rarity of the event. But for patients that have fatigue, it's on my battery of tests.
I remember melanoma people talking about patients who come in with headache. They have an enlarged pituitary on imaging, but I don't know, maybe that's more with anti-CTLA-4, I don't know.
It does seem like hypophysitis is more common with CTLA-4, and actually there's CTLA-4 can be expressed on the pituitary itself. It seems like one of the physiologies of that specific toxicity may involve the binding of anti-CTLA-4 antibodies directly to the pituitary and directing toxicity against that organ. And so there may be ways in which it's drug specific.
So another paper you had I was really curious about in the JCO a few months ago focused on pneumonitis.
Yeah.
And, you know, particularly in lung cancer, I think this is a really interesting question. We did a survey of a bunch of cases of patients treated in practice for metastatic disease, and it included quite a few people who got checkpoint inhibitors. And even though, quote, they're well tolerated, in this survey, a lot of people got taken off the drug, and I think because of a lung problem where they weren't sure whether it was from the drug or chronic lung disease or heart disease or whatever. But anyhow, what do we know about pneumonitis, particularly in lung cancer patients?
It's a real challenge, especially in lung cancer patients, to be able to distinguish the variety of things that can happen in the lung, whether that's pneumonia or cancer progression or pneumonitis. All of those things are possible, and they can often look similar to each other. I think one of the things that we tried to highlight with that particular report is that pneumonitis can occur at any time during treatment and can look like almost anything. We've had cases where on a CT scan, there was just a little focal bit of ground glass. There have been other times in which there's larger opacities that can even appear consolidated, ranging to bilateral ground glass opacities that I think are probably more considered a hallmark of pneumonitis. And so I think distinguishing those things is really a challenge. And actually, I don't have a great tip for how to figure it out. I think what often happens, particularly for people who are sick or hospitalized, is that you're left with trying to treat all the possible things at once just because people are so sick. Sometimes that leads to having to use antibiotics and steroids at the same time. Sometimes my own sense is that people who have pneumonitis, if they're going to get better from steroids, they tend to get better pretty quickly. And so sometimes what I've done is, especially for hospitalized patients, to start antibiotics and steroids and sometimes repeat a CT scan even just a few days later. And those patients who have pneumonitis tend to radiographically and clinically look better fairly quickly. While in patients with pneumonia, I think is well known, the CT scan can lag farther behind. So that's at least one way that I try and distinguish it for those who have severe illnesses.
So continuing on with your personal journal club, I see that at ASCO, you had a pretty cool, actually poster discussion paper on a really interesting issue, which is retreatment with immunotherapy after people have had toxicity. So before I ask you about it, I want to get your take on a case from Dr. Matt Gubins, who I also interviewed for a previous issue of this series. He told me about a really interesting case of a patient who had a great response to, I think it was either Nevo or Pembro, but got pneumonitis. And then he wanted to retreat and he didn't know what to do. And he actually gave the patient a tiso. And anyhow, it just brought up this issue of retreatment. So And incidentally, I'm curious to know what you would do with somebody who had a great response but still got pneumonitis. In this case, Matt's patient, I think, again, got better with steroids. I'm curious, where do you think things stand in terms of anti-PD-L1 versus anti-PD-1 in terms of toxicity, in terms of pulmonary toxicity? Matt was saying he wasn't at all convinced there was a difference, but atezolizumab is approved, so he tried it. You think there's anything to all that?
I think it's possible. It does seem like some of the reports from the PD-L1 drugs have a slightly decreased risk of toxicity, at least particularly related to pneumonitis. I think I saw one report of pneumonitis in PD-L1 treated patients was in the 1-2% range as opposed to the 4-5% range for the PD-1 drugs. I think in the case where someone who had a really nice response to PD-1 therapy but developed pneumonitis, my instinct would be to watch them, allow the pneumonitis to resolve, and see how durable that response to PD-1 therapy is in the first place. If they were to progress at some point in the future, I could understand the logic of trying a PD-L1 drug first. And even if they didn't respond to the PD-L1 drug, I might even try the PD-1 drug again, recognizing that there's an increased risk, but if you can recapture that benefit somehow, it's worth so much to the patient.
And what did you guys report on at ASCO on retreatment?
I think it's a really emerging population of patients that have these immune-related toxicities, and there is really no guidance for what to do. And that was the spur for us to look into this report. And what we did was to look back at all of our patients treated at Sloan Kettering and to identify those patients who had had some delay in their treatment. And we tried to adjudicate whether that delay was because of some other reason, whether it was because they progressed or because they were on holiday, and then to drill into those patients that had some delay because of a toxicity. Some of those patients that had a toxicity were never retreated, and I can appreciate many reasons for doing that. But about half of the patients actually were retreated. And so what we tried to describe was what happened to those patients who were retreated, how safe was it, and how effective was it? What we found was that of those patients who were retreated, about half of those patients had another immune-related toxicity that came back. And so about 50% of patients had some trouble when they were retreated. And I think that how you view that is one of the sort of it's in the eye of the beholder. On one hand, toxicity was not uniform. And so maybe it is possible to retreat some patients. On the other hand, there was an increased rate of toxicity. And I can understand some caution with retreating patients. I think our bar for what kind of toxicities we're willing to accept does have to be contextualized by what's happening with the patient, which is that they're suffering from an otherwise fatal illness. And so I think in that context, it makes me a little more willing to push the envelope sometimes.
And I mean, you're talking about a therapy that has the possibility of throwing them into maybe a prolonged, very good quality of life remission, otherwise downhill course.
And so that's why we also tried to determine, like, maybe you can retreat, but should you? And so another thing that we looked into was how people did by whether or not they responded and then were retreated, or if they didn't respond and were retreated. What we found was that those patients that had had an early response to treatment and then were either retreated or not, those patients did about the same regardless of whether they were retreated or not. And so it seemed that for those patients who are otherwise doing well already, it's changed my practice so that I don't rush to retreat those patients if they're otherwise doing okay. When comparing those patients that didn't have a response, though, there did seem to be somewhat of a benefit for those patients that were retreated. And so I think that if I were ever going to retreat somebody, it would probably be those patients that had a toxicity that occurred early. They hadn't benefited yet, so we weren't sure if it was going to help. And I might be more willing to try it in somebody who hadn't otherwise benefited. But if they're otherwise responding, I tend towards not treating them because there's the possibility of those durable memory responses that it can persist long after drugs given.
And it's really interesting hearing so many case stories over the last, maybe few years, starting with the melanoma people, then lung and everybody else. And there always are these cases of people who got stopped because of toxicity who then did great, unmaintained remissions. And I think that really also gets into the issue of duration. Just kind of curious, outside a trial setting right now, how do you decide whether about stopping?
That's a great question. I think that it's a relatively small population of patients. In some ways, I think the amount of time that we spend talking about this particular scenario might be disproportionate to how often it's happening. I think before, people may have assumed that a year of treatment was sufficient. And there was some interesting data from ESMO in patients with lung cancer who were treated with nivolumab, who at a year were randomized either to stop therapy or to continue. And there was a pretty clear difference where the patients who continued therapy beyond a year were improved in terms of progression-free survival and at least a trend towards a benefit in the overall survival. So I think that report had sort of reinforced to me that it seems like you might need more than a year of therapy. I think in my own practice, I have very few patients who are continuing therapy beyond 2 years. And that's less because I've set a hard deadline to stop and more that eventually something comes up that gives you a reason to stop, whether that's a toxicity, either mild or more severe. Sometimes it's fatigue. Sometimes it's the patient's request. But eventually we end up stopping at some point for many patients. And I can only think of one patient who's been on persistent therapy for more than 3 years.
So actually in kind of the same vein, and when you're talking about the idea of retreating and people being in a desperate situation, I was thinking in my mind also the issue of people with known prior autoimmune disease, and particularly the serious ones in terms of Crohn's or multiple sclerosis. And again, you hear this discussed, there are papers out there, again, it started with melanoma, but I see again at ASCO, you had another poster looking at that. What did you talk about there?
Yeah, I think the group at UT Southwestern had particularly highlighted just how frequent baseline autoimmune conditions are in patients with lung cancer to highlight that it's a large population and one that can't be ignored and one that we need to figure out what's safe and what's not. As you mentioned, I think in the melanoma literature, there has been some good descriptions of patients that had baseline toxicities. The first report focused on patients treated with CTLA-4 and a second that were treated with PD-1. I think both of those reports highlight that there probably is an increased risk of toxicity, but much like the retreatment population, it's not universal. And in some patients, they can benefit from treatment. And so I think my own instinct is that it shouldn't be an absolute contraindication to treat those patients. But it does require a good conversation about what are the risks, which are probably somewhat increased. What can you do about it if something happens? And what are the alternatives? But I can imagine for many people with some baseline autoimmune condition, I might get to a point of wanting to try it. I think there may well be very severe toxicities like scleroderma or others where you might be particularly cautious about wanting to treat that person just because of how bad it can get if there's some flare in their baseline condition. But again, just as you said, like if you're weighing it against the idea of otherwise dying from lung cancer, you're willing to do a lot.
We like to poll investigators just to see what they would do in practice. Of course, who knows? This is such a difficult decision to consider. But a couple of things that really seem to bring out red lights when we bring it up, even if there are no other alternatives, are autoimmune disease, particularly Crohn's, that requires infliximab. Or, and this I remember Chuck Drake brought up, his huge concern about anybody with multiple sclerosis, particularly if they've been treated. Again, any specific, I mean, obviously the worse it is, the better, but anything in particular that really rings your bell from that point of view?
Not specifically. I think that the rate of people that develop colitis who are treated with PD-1 therapy by itself is pretty low. And so I guess I wouldn't say Crohn's is an absolute contraindication for me. I think the one thing that I feel most cautious about is treating patients that have had a solid tumor organ transplant, There have been several reports of patients who have developed graft rejection and even some patients leading to death. And so I think I would go pretty far out of my way to avoid those therapies. I could understand some circumstance, particularly in patients that have an organ that can be supplemented, like a patient has a kidney transplant, you could theoretically be on dialysis. I could understand using it if you're otherwise dying, but I think the biggest red flag for me so far has been organ transplant patients.
So again, you had a paper presented at ESMO looking at immunotherapy patients with concurrent solid organ transplant, but also HIV, hepatitis B and C. What did you report there? We actually had a case on another series of a patient with a status post heart transplant, went into heart failure and died.
Yeah. No, I think that there are those reports that are beginning to populate the literature of organ rejection and death. And so I think it does highlight the real risk in that population. The report that you mentioned from ESMO was led by a group in Australia who tried to collect a worldwide series, both in lung cancer and melanomas and others, of some of these baseline conditions like HIV, hepatitis, and organ transplants to give a little bit more clarity to what's the safety profile in those populations. I think in the context of hepatitis, there's both these series as well as prospective clinical trials in patients that had hepatocellular carcinoma, in which I think the general consensus is that it's reasonable to use these drugs in those patients. I think it's possible there's a slightly increased risk of hepatic toxicity, but there's a real possibility of benefit. Nivolumab, for example, was just recently FDA approved for patients with hepatocellular carcinoma. And in my own experience, I've had a few patients that had liver toxicities. They were largely manageable. And I've certainly had patients that didn't have toxicity. So in hepatitis, I feel reasonably confident that it's okay to use those drugs, at least with a good discussion about the risks and benefits.
So another paper I want to ask you about, I started about a year ago hearing investigators, and I can remember your colleague Greg Riley was one of them, talking about the issue of checkpoint inhibitors in people with targetable mutations, particularly EGFR, which you're so much of, and concern or the thought, of course, they were excluded from the first-line trials, but also just generally the whole perception about these tumors and the relative lack of responsiveness. And you all had a data set or a paper that was really fascinating. And this was specifically looking at MET exon 14. Can you talk a little bit about your vision about checkpoint inhibitors in people with driver mutations and what you reported here?
Sure. It's true. My sense of patients with lung cancer that are characterized by specific driver oncogenes tend to be less responsive to PD-1 therapies. And whether that has anything to do with the specific driver, or I think more likely is that most of these patients are never smokers and as a result have fewer mutations in their tumor that I think predisposes them less well to response to therapy. So I think as a group, the likelihood of benefit when the oncogene-driven tumor seems to be lower. It doesn't eliminate the possibility of benefit, but it does seem to be lower. In the specific context of the MET exon 14 patients that we reported at ASCO, the experience was that similar to other drivers, that the response to PD-1 therapies was lower. And we had also tried to examine what the responses would like in groups of patients that would theoretically be even more likely to respond, those that had high PD-L1 expression or high mutation burden. And responses were few even in those populations. And so granted, these numbers are relatively small, and so I'd be cautious of drawing sort of a firm, broad conclusion from it. But I think that the overarching experience was that the responses, even in enriched populations, was less than you would have expected from the general population.
So I'm trying to remember if I've asked anybody this, but it just kind of popped into my head. I'm sure it's very obvious, an obvious question, which is, okay, so we think about EGFR, ALK, ROS1, you just talked about MET exon 14. But what about BRAF? What do we know about BRAF? Because you see more smokers and all. It kind of seems different.
That's a good point. I haven't seen any particular reports, at least in lung cancer. Certainly, there's a lot of effort in melanoma to examine how BRAF inhibitors may be synergistic or not with PD-1 therapies in melanomas. I'm not sure that there's been a firm conclusion from that. And I think that probably the biology of BRAF might not be exactly applicable to lung cancer. But you're right, there might be individual populations that are characterized by a specific oncogene, but may not have the same sort of low mutation burden landscape, and they could be different.
So another paper I wanted to ask you about, this was an oral looking at really the fascinating issue of neoadjuvant checkpoint inhibitors. This was neoadjuvant Nivo. And to get into that, how about if you present your patient?
Sure. So our group, along with a group at Johns Hopkins, have been working on a clinical trial in which patients get neoadjuvant nivolumab prior to surgical resection. And the original sort of purpose of this study was to show whether or not it's safe and whether it had any effect on surgery. Because understandably, I think that would be sort of a foundational building block for making sure this is a reasonable paradigm. And fortunately, we found that in the first 25 or so patients that were treated, there was no meaningful toxicities, no delay in surgery, which was fantastic. And then it raised the question of, that's great that it's safe, but is it helpful? And so what we looked to try and define how well it was working was a term that we had established a few years prior called major pathologic response, in which the pathologist looks at the tumor that's been resected and determines how much or what percentage of the tumor is dead and necrotic. And we've termed major pathologic response those patients that had more than 90% response pathologically. And fairly remarkably, in this small group of patients that were treated with nivolumab, more than 40% of patients had a major pathologic response, which was really quite stunning. The experience with chemotherapy is that it ranges in the 10 to 20% range. And so this was really encouraging. I had a particular experience with one patient who came from upstate New York who had stage 2 lung cancer. She was lovely. She was probably 75 or so. And despite living so far away, she had traveled to New York for her care and had met first with one of our surgeons. The surgeons have been fantastic about encouraging development and research in the space. And I saw her that same day. We talked about the clinical trial.
What was her tissue type?
She had a large cell neuroendocrine tumor, actually.
Large cell neuroendocrine tumor.
Hmm. So I was actually somewhat unsure whether this was the best option for her just because it required so much travel.
Can I just ask before you go on? Because, you know, it's interesting you mentioned that histology. Do you view that like just basically a non-squamous?
I do. I think that there is some literature emerging about how large cell neuroendocrine might be molecularly defined into somewhat two groups, one that defined by KRAS mutations or STK11 mutations that has a biology that might be more similar to adenocarcinoma. And then there's probably some subgroup that are defined by RB1 loss or mutations in P53 that seem to have a more small cell-like biology. And so I think as a group, they probably tend towards more like the small cell non-squamous patients. But I think that there are some patients that have a more small cell-like biology that seem to be somewhat more responsive to etoposide.
What about targetable mutations and mutation testing in those patients? And what kind of testing did she have?
At the time, she didn't have any particular molecular testing because we had just recently gotten her tissue from biopsy.
And she was curable, huh?
Yeah, she did. She had a stage 2 lung cancer. In general, my approach has been to do molecular profiling on large cell neuroendocrines, both because sometimes you do identify a targetable oncogene like EGFR, and also because of that concept that using some known sense of the mutational landscape might help define whether or not they have a more small cell-like biology or more non-small cell-like biology, which can help with choosing chemo.
So this lady was a candidate for surgical resection, and then the surgeon brought up the issue of participating in the trial.
She did. And so we met with her and talked about the trial, and she was all in. She received 2 doses of nivolumab, felt well with no side effects. On the CT scan, it did seem like there was somewhat of a response. And so that was certainly encouraging. And when taken to surgery, she had her primary removed as well as the hyla and mediastinal lymph nodes. And there was no tumor left. It was all necrotic after only 2 doses of nivolumab. It was really fascinating. She had previously had some hyalur lymph nodes that had been biopsied and were pathologically proven metastasis that were absent at the time of surgery. And so she's had a complete pathologic response. She's been disease-free now for 1.5 years since surgery and doing fantastic.
And she got no adjuvant chemo?
She didn't. We did talk about that because I think in the context of stage 2 disease, adjuvant chemotherapy would be a routine recommendation. I think in this context, knowing that she had had a complete pathologic response and somewhat cautious about whether the subsequent chemotherapy might abate the immune surveillance that was ongoing, I leaned towards not giving her chemotherapy, and she was comfortable with that.
Really makes sense. And as you say, really fascinating. Another issue, and I'm sure you must be looking at that, is the issue of tissue predictors of response. Of course, obviously PD-L1 levels. I'm curious what you looked at there. But thinking about the model that sort of developed in breast cancer, maybe not as much as we like, because certainly right now, ER and HER2 drive neoadjuvant therapy in breast cancer, but I'm not sure we've really gotten that far beyond it, some examples. What about predictors of response? What are you looking at? What do you think you're going to see in a patient like this compared to somebody who progresses?
Yeah, I think there's probably 3 clear modalities that seem to associate with response. And the first is using immunohistochemistry to examine PD-L1 expression. I think based on the KEYNOTE-24 study, PD-L1 expression should be a routine test for patients that have newly diagnosed lung cancer, because it does seem to enrich for benefit. And the patients that had high PD-L1 expression had a 45-50% response to pembrolizumab. Results updating the survival at World Lung report a median survival of 30 months, which is really amazing. And sort of along the survivals that we've gotten from targeted TKIs in patients with known oncogenes. So being able to identify a subgroup that truly responds has been transformative for our use of immunotherapy. But as a biomarker, it's also incomplete. PD-L1 doesn't guarantee a response, nor does if you're PD-L1 negative, sort of eliminate the possibility of response. So I think there are ways to find more nuance or better biomarkers as we move forward. And the other two that I think of include somatic mutation burden and probably emerging data related to gene expression profiles. With mutation burden, I think we found fairly clearly and across a few different tumors, including lung cancer, melanoma, and bladder cancer, that increases in somatic mutation burden associated with increase in benefit. And I think the routine use of multi-gene molecular profiling with platforms like Foundation Medicine and others, I think actually do give a pretty good estimate of mutation burden that probably is beginning to be incorporated in the way people practice already. I think the other marker that's somewhat more speculative at the moment is gene expression profiles and examining whether there's patterns that associate with interferon T-cell response in a tumor or other related signatures. I think that too may also help us define sort of the paradigm of warm versus cold tumors.
You know, it's interesting when you mentioned Foundation One, for some reason I flashed with great reminiscence on Vince Miller.
Yeah.
I used to love to interview him. Of course, he was on your faculty there at Memorial, and he was just so great to work with. And he's accomplished so much with Foundation Medicine, but I haven't been able to work with him. And I miss you, Vince.
You should keep really that in the video for sure.
he's awesome to talk to. But anyhow, what is it? I see that next gen platforms like Foundation One are kind of seem like they're trying to sort of figure out predictors to checkpoint inhibitors. What exactly are they looking at? I guess mutational burden?
Yeah, mutation burden seems to be the key. It's also a little crude, and so I'm sure that there's going to be more nuance that comes from this. But what we're doing basically is to evaluate how many somatic mutations were found in a tumor and count them. And it seems like those that have large numbers of mutations seem to respond better. The hypothesis seems to be that each time you have a mutation, you have the possibility of that mutation leading to a new protein that's called a neoantigen, a mutated protein that, when presented on the surface of a tumor cell by HLA-1 or class 2, basically acts like an antigen, one that the surveilling body hadn't seen before because it's mutated from self and therefore can potentially elicit a specific anti-tumor immunity in the same way that a foreign virus or bacteria theoretically could as well.
So I want to keep moving forward in terms of this discussion of some of the papers and new data sets that you've been involved with, but I do have to pause for a second. We referred to ESMO a couple times, and I thought ESMO 2016 was pretty wild, with the first line, chemo, pembrolizumab, and also an incredible ovarian paper at ESMO. But last year in lung cancer, ESMO, totally out of sight. I mean, they seem like they're somehow getting better stuff than ASCO, but
I don't know. It's timing, but they're doing good.
I mean, two gigantic practice-changing papers in lung cancer. Yeah. So one of them I want to ask you about, because it really ties into your case, is, of course, I think across the line, it's been unclear how checkpoint inhibitors are going to play out in the adjuvant or micrometastatic setting. And now, of course, for the first time, and I've got to ask you about, we see data of checkpoint inhibitors in locally advanced disease. The PACIFIC trial, looking at the anti-PD-L1 agent, durvalumab. Can you talk about what they looked at there, what they saw, and what you think it means?
Yeah, the trial called PACIFIC took patients with stage 3 lung cancer who were treated with chemotherapy and radiation, as would be standard, and then randomized those patients to receive either durvalumab, a PD-L1 drug, or the best supportive care, which would be the routine approach. And there was a really remarkable improvement in both disease-free survival, and although not technically statistically significant at this point, there was certainly a promising trend in terms of overall survival. This is really practice-changing from my perspective. The ability to move these therapies earlier and earlier in the disease course means the greater opportunity to not just treat patients, but to cure patients, which is ultimately a much more profound goal. And so the sheer magnitude of the benefit was, I think, particularly impressive.
But it's interesting, before it was presented and we knew from a press release that the trial was positive for PFS, I heard a lot of grumbling about we're in a curative situation, we need survival data, et cetera. But then when the data was presented, at least when we went to the ISLAC in Chicago, we polled some people and it seemed like people were kind of ready to go, so to speak. And it really gets into the question of the survival data of the trial. And is it that there aren't enough events to determine it and it's likely to be a survival benefit, or maybe there's just not going to be when it plays out?
Yeah, I can understand the caution and sort of jumping to a practice-changing conclusion in this setting based on disease-free survival alone. Understandably, the real goal of therapy in that context is cure. And so that's probably most manifest in things like survival. I think the things that changed the tide and just how clear the data was the magnitude of the benefit in disease-free survival, such that even if our like sort of dogma would say we should wait for survival, it seems unnecessary to wait several months or even a year while patients are actively having stage three disease now. And so I think the adoption of that change in the presence of a fairly substantial disease-free survival and a really clear trend in terms of overall survival made me feel comfortable adopting that therapy now.
Well, actually, when I saw that press release, I was equally curious about toxicity, because we already talked about your work looking at pneumonitis, and obviously chemoradiation therapy is certainly associated with that problem. It looked like, from what they saw, it didn't really seem that much, and I wonder what your thoughts were. And also, do you think that people who had the beginnings of pneumonitis got pulled out of the study? Or, you know, what do you think about those data?
Yeah, it's a good question. I'm not sure how rigid the restrictions were in terms of eligibility for those that had some evidence of radiation pneumonitis, but my general sense with radiation pneumonitis is that it occurs a bit later, and so may have not even been, even those patients that did have radiation pneumonitis, it wouldn't have been obvious at the time they were being considered for the study anyways. I agree with you that my sense of the toxicity data was very encouraging and that there was not any substantial increase in pneumonitis that would make me cautious about using it. And maybe it speaks to one of the things we were talking before about the relative safety of PD-L1 drugs in terms of causing pneumonitis. And maybe it justifies a particular use of that therapy in this setting, as opposed to assuming a broader use of PD-1 drugs also.
When you look at, I assume there are data on this, I guess, or certainly clinical experience, the typical natural history of chemoradiation associated pneumonitis. First of all, what fraction of patients get it? I mean, you know, obviously, individual variables. And then when they do develop it, what fraction get it right afterwards or very, very close time? And what fraction, as you say, are delayed?
Yeah. I don't know the specific data, but from my own experience, it seems like the rate of radiation pneumonitis after chemo-rads is probably in the order of 25 to 33%. My sense is that it usually occurs in the second to third month after treatment as opposed to right after. And I think they usually require fairly long course of steroids. In that way, the response to steroids seems a little bit slower than the response to steroids in patients that have autoimmune toxicities.
So it sounds like you are kind of ready to change your practice. And I'm curious, so this is going to be a year, right? Okay, so a couple of issues would be, first of all, I don't know how often you would see early radiation pneumonitis prior to when you would start the durvalumab. I guess you start it right afterwards, or do you wait a while?
I think most people probably will start pretty soon thereafter.
If so, somebody, like within a week or something?
I would guess within a month.
Okay, so within a month.
Yeah.
So if you have a patient who's maybe coughing a little bit, you got a little bit of stranding or whatever.
Yeah.
If you had a patient who was beginning to show that, would you still use the durvalumab?
I might lean against it, to be honest. I think in somebody that had clear evidence of pneumonitis, I think, one, they would need to probably be on steroids for that. And I think then the relative benefit of durvalumab probably be diminished, both because of the potential risk of furthering the pneumonitis and the concurrent steroids.
And I guess, and maybe with time, we'll start to see more details from the study to see what actually happened with these patients. But based on what you were talking about, you would assume that even in the control group, as you said, 25-35% of them are going to start to get pneumonitis during the year.
Right.
So, but they're going to be on durvalumab.
Yeah.
So, first of all, I assume, would you stop the durvalumab?
I probably would for some of the same reasons, both the need for steroids and the fact that it'd be hard to know which one's which.
And not restart it.
Probably not. And I think the retreatment data we were talking about before probably speaks to there's a pretty reasonable chance if you restart it, it's going to come back. My hope is that many patients may derive a bulk of the benefit from some of the early doses, such that maybe in the future we'll better understand just how long of therapy you need. Is a year necessary? I'm not sure. My guess is that for many of the people who truly benefit, some of the first 2 to 6 doses might be most important, especially when we think to some of the cases we've talked about already where people can have a complete pathologic response to just 2 doses of therapy.
You know, another thing I was thinking about with this specific trial is you hear people talking about, whether or not radiation therapy and chemotherapy in some way potentiate the benefit of immunotherapy, I don't know, exposing neoantigens, et cetera. Can you talk about that idea and whether you think that holds any water?
There's certainly a lot of discussion about whether radiation can be synergistic with immunotherapy. There's some nice preclinical data that suggests indeed it can, though it's not just radiation in general. There can be very specific ways of giving radiation that can be particularly helpful or not. I think that my own experience is that the benefits of radiation are not totally clear. I don't see many instances of, for example, that think that there was the hope that if you radiate people, you may generate this abscopal effect. And I can't think of any patients that I've seen that happen in. The PACIFIC trial certainly raises this question once again of whether durvalumab post-chemo radiation was effective because durvalumab works or because it was this particular setting in which it's given right after radiation. It gives more hope, I think, certainly to the possibility that there's some combinatorial benefit. But at least to my eye, it's not entirely clear.
Well, also, you know, when I think about this data you were talking about from your own work on neoadjuvant therapy, you know, there's no radiation therapy there, and it looks like you saw some pretty good effect.
Right. And in that way, some of the conclusions were those both PACIFIC and the neoadjuvant settings. One conclusion might be that the earlier stage of the tumors are actually responding better, and whether that's related to the sort of the nature of the host immune setting in the context of a newly diagnosed cancer as opposed to one that's been either there for longer or previously treated with chemo, or whether there's something about the nature of an earlier stage tumor, either its clonality or the nature of its associated inflammation. I think those other pieces may also contribute to why there's such a nice response in earlier stage tumors.
You know, it's interesting. Every year we go to the ONS Nursing Congress and put on a whole bunch of symposia. And the first thing I thought about, not the first thing, but we're writing the grants for those right now. And one of the things I thought of, when I saw that PACIFIC data, I'm like, wow, we're going to have to get the nurses on board for this. Because that year, a year, this isn't like just treating somebody with metastatic disease and most of them are going to go off. They're going to be on it theoretically for a year. All kinds of stuff are going to happen. They're going to get pneumonitis. They're going to get COPD exacerbation. And they're going to be on durvalumab.
Yep. No, it'll be complicated.
Any thoughts about how you would prepare your nursing staff and office staff to deal with this? To me, it certainly applies to checkpoint inhibitor toxicity in general, a different paradigm.
My sense is that we've gotten some good practice from treating patients in the metastatic setting, and that some of the considerations are going to be very applicable. There might be other parts that, as you mentioned, the radiation pneumonitis and that particular overlap require a bit of nuance and some care. But I think people are fairly comfortable with the use of these therapies, even over a long period of time, such that it's not totally cracking new ground. I think the space where it might be particularly important at a multidisciplinary level is what to do with stage three patients who present in the first place, who in another time we may have considered surgery, but maybe the use of durvalumab in patients who get chemo-rads sort of pushes that modality as a favored one. And I think that needs some good discussion across the community.
Well, also, based on what you were talking about in terms of your data with neoadjuvant therapy and the curative situation, you would think this would be, I mean, if you got 40% major, I mean, wouldn't you like to see that before you give the chemo rads?
Absolutely. And I think in some ways that would be the counterpoint to patients just getting chemo rads is that when you do neoadjuvant therapy and resect it, you know what you did. In the context of chemo rads and durvalumab afterwards, you really never really know who did you benefit, who responded, who didn't. Because there's no disease to follow. If patients progress, ultimately, that could be because they didn't respond. It could be because they responded but then became resistant. And the same is true for people who never respond. It's not clear that that means that durvalumab helped them or not, or maybe they would have been cured anyways. So there is real virtue in having the opportunity to understand what precisely is happening. The neoadjuvant setting and surgical resection certainly provide that window. And thinking about how to do this in a multidisciplinary way as we move forward will be really important.
So I hope you're going to tell me there are phase three studies that are underway looking at people both with surgically resectable and locally advanced disease with neoadjuvant checkpoint inhibitors first.
There's a clinical trial of nivolumab by itself, nivolumab with chemo or chemotherapy in the neoadjuvant setting followed by resection. The PD-L1 drug has a similar study as well.
That's what the tezolizumab?
Exactly. As far as I know, there is not a randomized study of patients with stage three disease who are getting neoadjuvant PD-1, PD-L1 therapy followed by surgery versus those who get chemo-rads followed by adjuvant PD-1, PD-L1? That might be a key question in the patients with stage 3 disease. As far as I know, it's not being done.
Well, I mean, I don't know. It seems like it ought to get done.
Yeah.
You tell me.
I think it'd be helpful.
So, I don't know. Sometimes I think things take a long time to evolve in lung cancer, and sometimes they get done fast. You know, like, I don't know, things like the Alchemist study, I thought that was going to go much quicker. I don't know. Is that going well, or do you know?
I don't know.
All right. I want to move on and also talk about some other work you've done that I've heard a lot of people commenting on, and certainly very important work looking at combination checkpoint inhibitors, specifically anti-PD-1, anti-CTLA-4 combination. Obviously, we see that in melanoma and other places. You've looked at it in non-small cell. What do we know about it at this point?
Sure. You're right. The combination of PD-1 plus CTLA-4 really emerged from the experience in melanoma, which the combination showed a really dramatic increase in response rate, and in randomized studies have shown a survival benefit. We've then translated some of that experience to non-small cell lung cancer and initially examined a variety of different doses of CTLA-4 plus PD-1 and found that, for reasons I can't exactly explain, at the higher doses of CTLA-4, like 3 mg per kg or higher, there was a fairly substantial toxicity in patients with non-small cell lung cancer that wasn't quite seen as profoundly in patients with melanoma. And as a result, we changed
the— Was that more colitis?
It was more everything. And I think the conclusion was more or less in lung cancer that 3 mg per kg or higher was basically intolerable. And so clinical trials have focused on a lower dose of the CTLA-4 inhibitors at 1 mg per kg every 4 or 6 weeks. And changing the dose and the frequency of the CTLA-4 inhibitors has really dramatically changed the tolerability of this combination. And I think, for my eye, it does make it sort of a very achievable combination, not just in specialty centers, but across the community. I think most intriguingly, though, has been that in the phase 1 trial of PD-1 plus CTLA-4, we did find a pretty substantially increased response rate relative to what would be expected with PD-1 therapy by itself. At different levels of PD-L1 expression, there seemed to be an approximate doubling of the response rate with the combination. And so certainly driven some enthusiasm for following that into phase 3 trials, which are ongoing now.
So what about, is the data encouraging enough? Obviously, both of these drugs are available to consider it outside a trial setting in metastatic non-small cell. Any situations, maybe patients sick, they need a response.
Yeah. In some ways, those patients who are particularly sick makes me a little bit more cautious of using the CTLA-4 because although the toxicity is better than at higher doses, there still is that increased risk of toxicity. My own instinct is that the CTLA-4 is contributing some degree to the response rate, and I've used it a few times in the off-label setting. My hope is that we'll have phase 3 data soon to be able to clarify just in whom that's the right thing to do and how often.
And I guess the key there, it kind of seems that maybe from a clinical point of view, it's not that meaningful. I mean, it's so hard to tease that out. You know, you see the response rates, but you tell me, I mean, you've treated a lot of these people. Do you have the feeling it's significantly more efficacious than just PD-1 alone?
I think it does. I think it does add something. I feel like in the patients I put on clinical trials with the combination, I feel like a little bit more confident with their possibility of benefit. It doesn't guarantee a response by any means, of course, but I think that there is some consistency in the data between non-small cell lung cancer, small cell lung cancer, melanoma, kidney cancer. In each of those settings, the CTLA-4 inhibitor is associated with some increased benefit.
Although, you know, I mean, you see a lot of things approved in oncology that really are, you know, pretty borderline. They're statistically significant, but, you know, the actual numbers are kind of small. I think the big thing that people think about with checkpoint inhibitors is the possibility of prolonged response, maybe unmaintained. Do you think that maybe is more common in people getting the combination?
I'm not sure, actually. I'm not sure that the duration of response is different. I think that probably the most clear thing is the increased response rate, the population of people who benefit in the first place. But it's not clear to me that there's a change or a difference in terms of how long those patients who respond actually benefit. My guess is that the PD-1 monotherapy responders and the combo responders have a similar outcome. It's just that there's more people in the combination group who are responding.
Right. The other sort of related question, and, you know, we like to survey investigators to kind of get a quantitative look at how we see things. And most of them, again, kind of are not that excited about using the combination outside a trial setting in non-small cell. But then their thoughts change a lot when they talk about small cell.
Yeah.
You agree?
I do. I think that in small cell, the response rate was double with the combination, and for reasons I'm not sure of, was actually somewhat low to monotherapy with a response rate sort of just hovering around 10%. And so for a disease in which the biology is particularly aggressive and options with durable benefit are very few, I can understand wanting to take your best shot at it.
Do you see either monotherapy or combination therapy getting approved in small cell?
I think so. I think that's part of the reason that the CheckMate 32 study did a randomized cohort in which patients were prospectively compared between monotherapy and combination to be able to inform the degree of benefit from the combination. And I hope that that can be a platform for FDA approval.
What do we know right now? We were talking about prior autoimmune and immune adverse effects. What do we know about paraneoplastic syndromes in small cell and checkpoint inhibitors?
That's a great question. I'm not sure that there's great sort of individual case reports or anecdotes to really inform it. My guess is that they can get worse with these sort of therapies. And I think there's probably a handful of cases who've had severe toxicities. In the CheckMate 32 study, there was a patient who died of myasthenia gravis, for example. And sort of extrapolating from another population, those with thymic tumors, it does seem like there's an increased toxicity risk in those patients, probably because the immunotherapy is modulating that paraneoplastic syndrome.
So speaking of combination of anti-PD-1, PD-L1 with anti-CTLA-4, I'm curious what your thoughts are about, I guess at this point, all we know is a press release about the so-called MYSTIC trial. We were talking about durvalumab before. And this is now first-line therapy of non-small cell, looking at durvalumab with anti-CTLA-4, tremelimumab versus just neither. Actually, the third arm was chemo, I guess, right?
Right.
Quote, it's a negative study. What I've seen is, quote, it's a negative study, and there was something about a 25% cutoff in terms of PD-L1 level, although I'm not sure if all that applied to all the patients, but I'm just kind of curious whether you know anything about that or have any thoughts about it or what it is you would like to know about it.
Yeah, it certainly was a disappointing result. I think that there certainly was high hopes for that being a positive study at its first look. The press release highlighted that, at least based on progression-free survival, that the combination didn't beat chemotherapy at either the all-comer group or in the PD-L1 high patients who were defined by greater than 25% expression. I think that there are some outstanding pieces that may flip the script on what to make of the study. And in particular, I think the survival analysis is still pending. And it's often been from immunotherapy studies that survival sometimes outpaces progression-free survival because of that tail on the curve that's possible. And so I think it's worth waiting for the survival data to be able to be more clear about what the interpretation of the study means.
Well, you know, of course, we have to see it. Incidentally, do you have any idea where or when it's going to be presented?
I don't know.
I mean, when I first heard about it, the thing that made sense to me was the 25% versus 50% with Pembro.
Yeah.
Because the first line Nevo study was also negative. So Right. Maybe it's about, does that make sense?
I'm not sure if the cut point was too low, or another interpretation is that because the study wasn't specifically initially powered for a PD-L1 cut point, but otherwise was looking at all comers, it may have been somewhat underpowered for that PD-L1 specified subgroup.
So I have to ask, even though, of course, I wanted to focus on immune therapy with you today, but you know, talking about ESMO, I have to ask you about the FLAURA trial, which
sure.
is like amazing.
Just yeah.
Like, not necessarily surprising, but just like, whoa, here it is,
yeah. You know?
So as you know, this looked at osimertinib versus, I don't know, was it erlotinib or erlotinib-gefitinib in the other group? And so maybe you can talk about what they reported and what you think it means.
Yeah, I think to me, sort of along the lines of what you're saying, it was practice changing. Osimertinib improved survival over the first generation TKIs in a fairly dramatic way. Not only that, but it's also better tolerated and diminishes the outgrowth of some of our most common mechanisms of resistance, namely T790M. And so for me, for a newly diagnosed patient with a known EGFR mutation, OC would be my first choice.
So I'm curious, too, what your experience has been with OC in terms of tolerability. You hear that it has less effect on wild-type EGFR, less skin problems, less diarrhea. Does it cause these problems at all?
Not usually. I think the drug is remarkably well tolerated. I think in patients of mine who've previously had erlotinib and then progressed and were switched to OC, almost all of them feel better.
When this was first reported, we were at the ISLAC meeting, We heard people saying what you just said, which is they're going to switch their first-line therapy. And then the second thing, the thing that popped into, we spent the last couple of years trying to hammer into people's head, T790 mutation testing, plasma assays, et cetera. Is that all out the door now?
That's a good question. It might be. I would imagine that it may cause some sort of evolutionary shift in the spectrum of resistance that we see. It seems from the initial Flora report that the outgrowth of T790M positive clones was low, if not absent entirely. And so I imagine that if you were to look at a paper 2 or 3 years from now at the resistance mechanisms after first-line therapy, they may look very different than the pie chart that's present now.
I want to maybe just complete our conversation here by asking you, what are some of the trial concepts out there right now, the trials and trial concepts that you think are going to affect practice in terms of lung cancer, particularly as it relates to checkpoint inhibitors, you know, in the next couple of years?
I think there's a few trials that we'll probably get some insight to even just over the next few months, if not just the year. And those include the large group of studies that are evaluating chemotherapy plus PD-1 or PD-L1 inhibitors. The KEYNOTE-189 study is pembrolizumab with chemotherapy, a phase 3 study that's meant to follow up the results from KEYNOTE-21G.
Again, that's non-squamous?
That's non-squamous, so carbo-pemi.
What about squamous?
And then in squamous, there's a variety of studies evaluating, I think they're all called Empower, evaluating things like carbopaclitaxel with or without atezolizumab. There's studies of carbo plus Abraxane in patients with squamous cell carcinoma with or without atezolizumab. So I think that there's going to be a large bit of data over the next year or so that will help inform just how well, if at all, chemotherapy is contributing to survival when combined with PD-1 inhibitors.
You mentioned the issue of bevacizumab with a checkpoint inhibitor, and I've heard things about like that anti-angiogenics in some way maybe even work through the immune system. What do we know about that, and what do we know about theoretically the combination of an anti-angiogenic and a checkpoint inhibitor?
It does seem like there are some clues, both from the laboratory research as well as some initial clinical trials, that anti-angiogenic inhibitors such as bevacizumab and others may be synergistic with immunotherapies. There's an experience reported at AACR this past year in renal cell carcinomas. There's been a variety of anti-angiogenesis TKIs in renal cell carcinomas with or without immunotherapies that have been promising. In lung cancer, there's been some small bits of data with ramucirumab and pembrolizumab that have been encouraging. And so I think paired with the preclinical data, I think there's reason to hope that there's some good rationale for antigenesis with immunotherapy.
Another frontier issue, or we're seeing a lot of research, and actually right now we're trying to put together some grant proposals, so we got to get more into basic science for that. We're trying to think about what could we talk about in that thing that would be more sort of biologic molecular. And I was thinking to myself, because we were talking about how MYSTIC, maybe it's because of the trial, but for some reason is negative. Obviously, we're seeing positive data with Pembro. Nevo was negative in the first line setting, and Pembro wasn't. There's always been this idea that when you ask people, you think there's any difference between any of these drugs, everybody always says, well, no, at least not clinically. But biologically or pharmacologically, what actually is the difference between, let's say, the checkpoint inhibitors that are out there right now that are approved in their structure and what they do? I mean, is there any reason to believe that somehow they might be different enough to see different results sort of intrinsically?
Yeah, there certainly are not a really clear body of data to say that there's differences between the drugs. The first line studies of Nevo and Pembro seem like outliers rather than sort of evidence of a trend that there's a difference between Nevo and Pembro. I think if you were to look at the individual drugs, there are some differences. Pembrolizumab, for example, has particularly high affinity for binding to PD-1, a little bit higher, maybe a log higher than nivolumab does. Certainly, there's structural differences in terms of the specific receptor between the PD-1 and PD-L1 binding drugs. And then the Fc domains of the individual drugs, either the IgG1 or IgG4, humanized or engineered, all of those features have the theoretical potential to modify the relative benefit of a given drug. So if ultimately we were to find that there was some true differences, I think those features may explain why there's some differences. But at least to date, I don't see a clear clinical difference between the classes or between the drugs.
It was never one of my few strengths. And, you know, I was thinking to myself, biologically, I don't know if you know, like other examples, for example, non-steroidal AIs in breast cancer. You know, people interchangeably use letrozole and anastrozole. Are they really exactly the same?
Yeah, I don't know.
They're probably not exactly the same. So I don't know. I get the feeling clinically that people view checkpoint inhibitors kind of the way they view AIs.
Yeah,
that
they're interchangeable.
But on the other hand, you're kind of like, you got to follow the data. So I'm assuming you have FDA issues also, but for example, durvalumab, I imagine, unless you see data with the other ones, is the only thing that's going to be used with locally advanced disease. Wouldn't you assume that?
I suspect so, yeah. And I think that may sort of speak to what we were talking about before in terms of whether there's any even small differences in terms of pneumonitis. I think that could be one justification for favoring the PD-L1 drugs and that is special in that particular setting. But ultimately, I think that the drugs are pretty similar.
Any thoughts about the issue of checkpoint inhibitors and mesothelioma?
There was some really nice data from the French group at ASCO that highlighted that both nivolumab and nivo plus ipi can work in mesothelioma. There have been previous data with pembrolizumab in mesothelioma. I think at a minimum, it highlights that there's a real possibility to benefit of these drugs in that disease. And so I would certainly encourage exploration that can move towards some regulatory approval. I think the proof of principle is there that it can work. I think absent is really clear data about why it works in some than others. That's not unique to mesothelioma. Obviously, in many diseases, that's entirely unclear. But I think identifying whether PD-L1 is relevant or not could be helpful.
I mean, you would think there should be a lot of mutational load there.
I would imagine so.
Although I think I've heard maybe there isn't. I'm not sure. You know?
Yeah, I think I'm not sure, to be honest, about what the landscape looks like. My understanding is that there's a TCGA mesothelioma report that's in progress, and I think will help clarify what the molecular landscape looks like.
And mesothelioma has kind of a, I don't know, I'm not going to say slow natural history, but not the same kind of progression you see with, say, non-small cell. Do you think there's any evidence that you see, you know, quote, the prolonged responses with mesothelioma that you see with other cancers, including non-small cell?
I think so. That may be my guess is, yeah, I think that the same possibility of durable benefit seems to be transferable from cancer to cancer. As far as I know, there hasn't been a really clear distinction between the sort of duration of response from one cancer to the next.
And actually, I was just thinking about the fact that, again, trying to think about sort of biologic topics that we could talk about at AACR. So we were talking about mesothelioma in terms of predictors of response. We sort of alluded to that a couple times today, but maybe you can just sort of take a step back and talk a little bit about your view about, you know, what the best predictors are, particularly in terms of PD-L1 levels in non-small cell.
Yeah. My guess is that there's probably not going to be any single test that gives us the best bit of information, and that it'll ultimately be a composite piece of information that may help us better be able to find sort of really enriched populations of benefit. I think the CheckMate 026 study, although negative for its primary endpoint, I think was really helpful in giving some insight into the ways in which tumor mutation burden and PD-L1 can interplay and identify patients with particular benefit. Those patients.
Can you talk a little bit more about that study?
So in CheckMate 26, it was patients with first-line lung cancer who were randomized to nivolumab or chemotherapy. The primary analysis was stratified by those patients who had greater than 5% PD-L1 expression, and there was no improvement in progression-free survival, overall survival, which defines sort of the negative outcome of the study. But in a subgroup analysis or an exploratory analysis of a subgroup, they looked at about 300 patients who they were able to do whole exome sequencing on their tumors, half of which who had gotten chemotherapy and half of which who had gotten nivolumab. And when mutation burden was broken down into tertiles so that the upper tertile was compared to the lower or medium tertiles, it seemed like there was a really clear distinction between the patients who were benefiting from nivolumab, wherein those that had high mutation burden had a very clearly improved progression-free survival compared to those who had low mutation burden. Then the flip experience was actually seen in those who were treated with chemo, wherein the patients that had low or medium mutation burden did particularly well with chemo. And it starts to outline a paradigm in which some of these markers may not just distinguish who should get PD-1, but who may also actually benefit better from chemo. They took a next step and then combined mutation burden with PD-L1 data and found that those patients that were both mutation burden high and PD-L1 high had the particularly enriched response rate, I think up to 75%. And if you had only one of those markers, the response rate was intermediate, maybe around 30%. And if you had neither of those markers, the response rate was quite low, like 10%. And so it starts to give you that sense that maybe as we start to put combinations of markers together, we can provide much more nuance in terms of understanding who benefits and who doesn't.
You know, it's a really interesting thought, though, predicting benefit from chemo, because actually, if you think about it, maybe it sort of makes sense. Less mutation burden, or less mutations, less possibility for resistance. I don't know. Is that the way you would?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that the idea that mutation burden is a good thing is really only true in the context of immunotherapy, wherein a given mutation has the potential to generate a new antigen. But in overall tumor biology, each mutation represents a new bypass pathway. And so I think that in the context of chemotherapy, maybe a genetically simpler tumor is more sensitive to chemotherapy. And I think that context is particularly important when we think about clinical trials that are ongoing now, where the goal is to induce mutations through things like PARP inhibitors or temozolomide or others. I think there's reason to be a little cautious about whether that's a good thing, especially given the possibility that you're making a tumor more aggressive in absence of a real benefit from immunotherapy.
You know, I was kind of flashing on all the studies that looked at chemo versus targeted therapy first line, like IPASS, looking at TKI versus chemo. And I remember people saying, oh, well, the people in the chemo arm did really well. So do we know that people like with targetable mutations actually get more benefit from chemo with the same idea, less mutation burden?
I don't know of data aside from things like IPASS, where and it did seem like those that had EGFR mutations did particularly well. There have been a few case reports in individual driver oncogenes like ALK and RET and ROS, where some of those patients who were treated with chemotherapy did really exceptional. I think the median progression-free survival of ROS1 rearranged patients treated with pemetrexed-based chemotherapy was like a year or 18 months, like really exceptional. So it does seem like there's some signal that the benefits of chemotherapy can be exceptional in those that have low mutation burden.